Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Some showers and storms are expected to eventually sweep through the area this afternoon and early evening. Some of those storms could potentially be on the stronger side. Till then, expect cloudy, warm, muggy conditions with a high around 87. In addition, there is a moderate swim risk in Lake Michigan along Racine and Kenosha counties. For tonight, some lingering showers and storms are possible, a low of 67. Tomorrow, Thursday, mostly sunny, definitely cooler, a high of 76. The five-day weather trend, temperatures climbing again with highs for the weekend well into the 80s. The next chance for some showers and storms after today coming up on Sunday. Currently, mostly cloudy skies, a temperature reading of 78. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, I am so happy to be welcoming into our studios for the first time, and it is an overdue invitation extended to a gentleman that I know many of you know, Frank Edgerton, Dr. Frank Edgerton, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And Professor Edgerton has written extensively on the history of ecological sciences and other topics related to ecology. But what we're going to spend most of our time talking about today is a very personal book. It concerns an issue and topic of national importance, but he has written it both from a perspective of his own professional expertise as a historian, as well as just as a concerned citizen, the book called Gun Crazy America, A History and Critique of Our Gun Culture. I'm so happy that this book was brought to my attention by Professor Edgerton's good friend, Mary Beth Zilke, who is a retired teacher with the Kenosha Unified School District and also retired from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, where she helped to supervise student teachers there. And she is the one who actually, I think, sent me this book and alerted me to it. And I'm so glad that at long last we can have a conversation about it. And so Mary Beth is in the studio as well. So Professor Frank Edgerton and Mary Beth Zilke, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Glad that you're here. Mary Beth, I want you to tell our listeners a little bit about your own encounter with this book and what got you kind of very excited about it. Maybe ahead of it, maybe just say a quick word about how you knew Professor Edgerton in the first place.
Well, I knew Professor Edgerton from he and his wife, Andrea, were members of the Olympia Brown Unitarian Church, and we were friends there. And also from Diner Circle, and his wife was involved in AAUW, American Association of University Women. And we have the same philosophy about what to do, that each of us can make a difference, and how important it is to educate our friends and our family about our points of view.
That reminds me that you have written a children's book that someday we need to talk about. Just tell our listeners it's the title and what that
it's
book
called,
is about.
It's called The ABCs of How to Be a Good Citizen. And, of course, right now that's one of the things that we all have to work on, being good citizens. If we disagree, we can agree to disagree. And which aspects of citizenship are important and how early it is to promote that with young children all the way from kindergarten through middle school and high school have had fun doing some brainstorming and ways that they can become good citizens.
Great. So good citizenship is not something where we wait for adulthood to come, but even as youngsters. So tell our listeners about your first encounter with Professor Edgerton's book, Gun Crazy America.
Well, we were talking about some things, and I stopped by to be a dog walker for him and his dog Fuzzy, and he showed me that the book was just published, and I was very impressed with it. It just made me really understand the whole history, and again, the gun culture that really bothers me too. I don't mind, my brothers were hunters and did things, you know, shot pheasants and stuff like that. But that now kids 18 to 30, all they want to do is own a gun. And that really stresses me out. In my day, people wanted to smoke in the 60s. That was the big thing. Oh boy, we got to have a cigarette. But then when we learned that cigarettes cause cancer, now many people, well, I never smoked, but a lot of people change their point of view and don't smoke. And I think that's what we have to do, is show the danger of guns and possession of guns, and especially the assault rifles are awful.
So, hence the mission behind this book, which we'll be talking about in just a moment, again titled Gun Crazy America, A History and Critique of our Gun Culture. Before we talk about this book, Professor Edgerton, I think it would be good for our listeners to know a little bit more about you, about where you come from originally, and a little bit about your professional life, which, of course, was spent for many years at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, our neighbors to the north here. So tell us a little bit about your background.
I'm from North Carolina. My father was a professor at Duke University. So I grew up in Durham, and I went to Duke as an undergraduate. Free tuition.
Not bad.
I was in the Boy Scouts growing up, and that was very meaningful to me. The only gun we had in our house was a squirt gun when I was a young teenager. I went to the films on Saturday afternoons and saw a lot of films about guns in the West and so forth. So I was aware of gun culture, but I was sort of on the very periphery of it. Didn't have any guns to speak of. And my father did not hunt, and neither did I. So I was not part of the gun culture, really. And my focus on guns came when President Kennedy was assassinated in 1963. And what happens when Congress has to confront that? Nothing. Nothing. So that was pretty upsetting. And then in 69, Robert F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King were both assassinated. And what did Congress do? Nothing. So that was how I got focused on the problem of guns. And I assumed that someone would write this book, but no one did. And so I finally decided, well, I'll do it myself. So I was not oriented toward the gun culture, but I assumed this role as a citizen. So that was my background. I was a historian, but not in this social area.
I want to take just a brief detour to talk about what it is that, in fact, your academic life has been focused on. I mean, it's been history, but specifically history as related to ecology. Explain to our listeners what your focus has been and where that interest came from.
Well, I had a strong interest in nature as a teenager, and the Boy Scouts was a way of sort of getting out into nature, which I greatly valued. And so when I went to Duke, my major was zoology. And when I graduated from Duke with that major, I went to North Carolina State College in Raleigh to study ecology. And I enjoyed it, but I also realized I did not really want to be a scientist. And so what could I do? I somehow found out about history of science as a profession. And so I thought, well, maybe I could do history of science, and the science I worked on would be ecology.
So you have, over the years, studied and taught about how the science of ecology over the years has evolved. I mean, in other words, what ecology once was and what ecology has become over the years. Is that what you have traced in your studies?
Yes, it is. I started in antiquity, and I wrote a book about the origins of ecology down to 1900. So the book that I have just finished writing takes the story through the 1900s. Hmm. So that was a sequel to the one I published in 2012.
Very good. So you're still writing. You're still in the business of writing.
Yes, I am. It sort of became a hobby. Hmm. And going through the universities, I learned to write because I had to. And so I found that with the subject I wanted to write about, that I enjoyed doing it. Hmm.
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking today on the morning show with Dr. Frank Edgerton, a professor emeritus of history from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. With him as well, his good friend and I think maybe neighbor, Mary Beth Zulke, a retired Kenosha Unified School District teacher who brought to my attention one of Professor Edgerton's books, really the only book he's ever written, I think, designed for the general public in mind versus the other books that he's written, have been a more of specifically academic nature. This book called Gun Crazy America, A History and Critique of Our Gun Culture. So I think it's safe to say that in your book, what you are trying to do more than anything is maybe help explain where this gun culture comes from.
Yes.
And of course, one could actually and probably should read about that history wherever you happen to fall on that divide in terms of if the gun culture is something that one embraces and feels great about, that's what it means to be American. Or if, on the other hand, you're somebody with grave concerns about the gun culture, however you feel about it, it probably is helpful and important to understand where this has come from over the years. Did you think about that as you wrote the book?
Yes, of course. The gun culture came with the Europeans to America. And specifically, of course, in America, the English. They brought their guns with them, guns which I guess they used to hunt in England, but they used it to both hunt and to keep the Indians in line as they saw it.
So that helps us understand, at least to a point, why this gun culture has emerged here versus not nearly so much in other Western countries. But for instance, if England came over here with guns, a gun culture like we have here has not really emerged in England itself, for instance. So there's something, of course, about the way in which this nation was shaped in its early history that led to this kind of the fermentation almost of what has ultimately become this gun culture. And you trace quite a lot of this in your book. So what is it about the way our nation was shaped in its earliest years that led to the emergence of this fascination and even love of guns?
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course, hunting was important when the colonists came because they didn't bring a lot of food with them. They had to scramble to get food when they were here. And America was blessed with a very abundant wildlife. So it wasn't very much of a challenge to go out and acquire what you needed to put on the table. And so that was part of it. But then, as I say, keeping the Indians at bay was also part of it. Indians, of course, had their own weapons, but they were not as effective as guns. And, of course, the Indians were very desirous of acquiring guns of their own in order to stand up to the Americans. Hmm.
One of the things you also talk about in your book is the fact that when we eventually emerged as a nation, we were this, in a sense, kind of uneasy mix, that we were one nation, but we were 13 colonies, 13 states, and that while it worked beautifully in maybe some ways, was also very tricky because you had people in these various states concerned about their own constituencies and concerned about the federal government and how powerful it might be. And it sounds like, because you talk about that in your book, like that was a contributing factor as well in terms of some people feeling like it was important to own guns in order to fight off something that the federal government might do. In fact, I think you even liken some colonists likening the federal government to the government in England that they had just thrown off. So is that the parallel that you're drawing here?
Well, that was part of the story, yes, important. The War of Independence was to throw off the British who wanted to dominate the colonies and were invested heavily in them. And yet the Americans felt that overseering of the colonies was too oppressive. And so they decided to throw off that British dominance. And the way to do that was to bring their guns to the battlefield. And so this became a third dimension of the gun culture, not just for hunting and for keeping the Indians at bay, but also of freeing America from what was perceived to be the oppression of Britain.
One of the things you spend some time with in your book is exploring why the Second Amendment was crafted and what its intention was and some of the ways in which perhaps modern-day Americans misunderstand the background of the Second Amendment. Explain, as you understand it, why that Second Amendment was crafted, what its purpose was, and maybe how that purpose is misunderstood all these years later.
Well, that involves the development of the Constitution after the War of Independence. And so that was one of the thoughts that they had, that, well, we just got rid of one tyrant. We don't need another one. And so some of these colonists thought, well, the federal government is our institution, but maybe it could get out of hand also. And so we need to have this ability to defend ourselves within our colony if the federal government becomes an arbitrary bully the way we thought the British became. So this was an insurance that the federal government would not become a bully, that the states could have their own militia. And so it was really the militia that was behind the Second Amendment. They wanted to be sure that the federal government could not take the guns away from the militia. And in the state militias, the guns were personal guns that were brought to the militia by the citizens. The militia itself might have had a few guns, but it was not heavily armed. So the personal guns contributed to the defiance of the militia.
I guess that's why that crossover occurs so naturally then, when some people look at the Second Amendment and say, that is there so I can have a closet full of guns in my house, versus guns being possessed for the purpose of a well-regulated militia. I mean, that's not a huge leap that a lot of people are making about what that Second Amendment was all about, when you clarify what the earliest history of it was.
Well, so this tension did not become a conflict until the Civil War. And the Civil War had the South break away from the Union because the nasty Northerners wanted us to get rid of our slaves. So that was the attitude of the South, that slavery was part of our freedom, that we were free to have slaves. No one thought of the fact, well, maybe the slaves should have freedom. That was not a thought that was developed in the South. So the South broke away, and they used guns to enforce their breakaway. Actually, when the Union was developed, there was no law that says, well, if you join the Union, you can't get out. So this was just an attitude of the North that, no, you're here to stay. And the South felt, well, no, we're not here to stay.
We're done.
Yeah. So they took up arms, and then they lost the war.
We're speaking with Dr. Frank Edgerton about his book, A Gun Crazy America, A History and Critique of Our Gun Culture. The book, in part, tries to trace the development of the gun culture that we see in a modern America, whether for good or for ill. It's there, of course. There's no denying that. And Professor Edgerton's book, among other things, explores sort of the through line of how this nation initially took shape and how this gun culture ultimately took hold as other events unfolded through the course of our history. There's a very interesting chapter in your book when you talk about technological breakthroughs in the production of guns, how that once upon a time, in fact, in the period when we're first talking, that guns were made one by one. And so it was actually exceedingly expensive. And so very few people had guns. It's the opening of chapter four. Guns and ammunition were produced by craftsmen through the end of the 1700s. A gunsmith made one gun at a time, and only prosperous men could afford to own one. So summarize how that changes. I think this is a story about guns that most of us know very little, if anything, about.
Well, actually, the Industrial Revolution was far broader than the guns, but guns were part of it. And so as the technologies of the Industrial Revolution developed, they were applied to guns. Oh, yeah, well, as long as we have this capability, let's apply it to guns. And so guns could then be manufactured the way other parts of the technology of society were being manufactured.
One of the most interesting stories you tell in the book is about a famous American by the name of Eli Whitney, responsible for the cotton gin. But you tell an interesting story about how Mr. Whitney was involved, at least for a time, in the production of guns, but in a way that was, the way you describe it, a little bit shady. Do you remember the story I'm talking about?
Actually, I wrote the book in 2018. My memory is not very good. So you remind me what I wrote.
It was towards the end of the Revolutionary War, I think, and where there was a real need for guns to be produced in larger and larger numbers. And Eli Whitney, who apparently had fallen on very hard times financially, stepped forward and said that he would be able to produce quite a few guns very, very quickly, but in fact was not able to. And the few guns he did create were of very poor quality. So it kind of tarnished the reputation of Eli Whitney, the inventor of the cotton gin. But ultimately, what your book really chronicles for us is how guns became more and more efficient. Not only were they produced in greater and greater numbers, but also the efficiency of guns, the kind of damage they could do, also grew almost exponentially, it seems, over the years.
Yes, technology was expected and did continue to improve everything that it made. Cars, for example. The early cars in America were pretty quaint by modern standards because they were not terribly efficient. But everyone expected they would get better, and they did. And the same was true of other things in the technological revolution, including guns.
And you tell us that by the time the war between the states emerges, guns have really become terrible killing machines. In fact, I think in your book you talk about how it is during the Civil War that we see the first examples of what we think of as the machine gun, that technology, at least in its infancy, dates all the way back to the Civil War.
Yeah. So it was, of course, then a relatively modest machine gun. Today, of course, you can just mow down people left and right, as we've seen being done in modern America in shopping malls and churches and schools. And so that's a byproduct of technological efficiency that eventually was used against society.
Your book also chronicles the emergence of gun laws through our history. And, of course, part of your perspective is that we need many more gun laws and stronger gun laws. And we'll talk in a moment about the forces that have been making that difficult. But your book does talk about how even in the early part of the 19th century, there were gun laws being enacted to, in a sense, regulate the possession of guns, who could own guns and under what circumstances. I found that kind of fascinating because I think a lot of us imagine or just assume that in the earliest days of Andrew Jackson and whatever, anybody in America could walk around owning a gun. And even in our early history, there were at least a few gun laws in place.
There were gun laws, but there were not efficient means to enforce them. So the laws were on the book, and they were sort of what you should do, but a lot of people ignored that and felt that, well, we have freedom of gun ownership, and so I'll interpret that law to suit myself.
Of course, one of the forces that is working relentlessly, first of all, to discourage the enactment of gun laws and to maybe undermine or weaken or eliminate gun laws that are already in place, is the NRA, the National Rifle Association. And you spend quite a large portion of the book actually talking about the emergence of the NRA, its somewhat checkered history, and something about why it has become so incredibly effective. For the sake of any of our listeners not acquainted with this history, what do you think is most important for us to know about when and under what circumstances the National Rifle Association first emerged?
The National Rifle Association was created primarily by the military after the Civil War because they saw that the Southern troops were largely from rural areas and they grew up hunting. They just had to walk out of the door and down the road a bit and they would encounter wildlife, which they could then shoot and bring home for the kitchen. And so when the Civil War came, these Southerners were already used to using guns. And so they had a certain level of expertise that the soldiers in the North did not have because most of the Northern soldiers came from urban environments where the use of guns was not routine. Mm. And so most of the soldiers did not have any experience with guns. So the NRA was to give the Northern young men an opportunity to learn about guns in case there was another war in which the opposition had an advantage. So it had a patriotic origin.
Interesting. And largely in the North, although, of course,
yes,
its influence spread far and wide. You talk about kind of the history of the NRA, that there have been certain points in its history when it was maybe losing its potency, maybe losing its relevancy or whatever, and then would kind of surge to the forefront of that again. But I think it's safe to say that it is in the 20th century that we see the National Rifle Association in its heyday. I mean, as perhaps the single most effective lobbying organization in the country. What do you see as the biggest reasons why the NRA has been so effective in this part of their mission, that is, of fighting back against the enactment of gun control measures? What have they been doing right over these years? I mean, so to speak. I mean, depending on how you view what they're doing.
Well, the manufacturers of guns and ammunition started advertising their products right around the turn of the century, from 1800s to 1900s. And they discovered that people did not respond very positively to the manufacturers pushing guns on the American people. So they got the idea, why don't we give our money to the NRA, let them do the advertising. And so that's what happened, that the gun manufacturers sort of took over the funding of the NRA, and the NRA in turn responded positively to this gift from the manufacturers. And so that's the dynamic that kept it going. But then there was the other problem of selling guns to the public. And to a large extent, the membership of the NRA are the lower class that feel they are not in control of society and that at least they want to be in control of their lives. And so mostly people who don't have a higher education, where they don't have sophistication about how governments work, and they want to get advice on what to do about it. And owning a gun became the reassuring way to be sure the government is not oppressive.
Interesting. And so the NRA has, in a sense, capitalized on that sort of fundamental fear that some Americans have about their own government and the potential for what their government might do. That the NRA has found very effective ways to exploit that, in a sense.
Yes, that's right. That people who don't run the government and don't understand in any detail the dynamics of government want to at least be sure they can control their own lives, their own home.
And control ownership of their own guns.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a way for them to feel like they have power let's call it power, or in if they feel that they are lacking it in other aspects of their lives. And that's, you argue in your book, that is one very important component in terms of those who are kind of the general membership of the NRA. One of the things that is curious is that the NRA is this incredibly potent political player, even though in terms of the overall population of the United States, the number of their membership is relatively modest. I mean, it's not a huge swath of the population that belongs to the NRA, and yet it seems like they have influence that is sort of outsized. I mean, a larger influence than we might expect given the small percentage of Americans who actually belong to the NRA. How would you explain that?
Well, I think to explain it, we have to see the NRA, as you say, as an effective lobbyist. And so that money from the manufacturers and also from membership enable the NRA to hire very effective lobbyists. And as you say, they have often been the most effective lobbyists, or at least one of the most effective, since they began to get this money from both the gun manufacturers and from the membership. And so all their membership is not large, its membership can be encouraged to participate very actively in local politics. And so local politicians learned that these NRA members have to be respected. And the connection between the NRA and the Republican Party, it is not automatic. In fact, sort of logically, one would think that the NRA would be allied with the Democrats because the Democrats see themselves as the People's Party, and the membership of the NRA see themselves as the people. Hmm. So logically, why aren't the NRA closely allied with the Democrats? And the answer is, well, the Republicans had to have a constituency that went to the polls. And so, in a sense, they learned to pitch their programs to the membership of the NRA, but focused on the Republicans.
And the effects, or the effectiveness, speaks for itself. By the way, speaking of advertising, and who and in what way guns are advertised, you tell a really interesting story in the book about going back to old issues, back issues from the 1950s. Of Boys Life magazine.
Yeah.
And tell our listeners what you found when you looked in some of those early issues of a magazine you remembered reading once upon a time.
Yeah, I grew up reading the Boys Life because it was allied with the Boy Scouts. And I was, as I said, quite active in the Boy Scouts. In fact, most boys, as they got older, went into sports, and they dropped out of the Boy Scouts. I was not into sports And so I stayed in the Boy Scouts. And retrospectively, looking back, I suspect my troop leaders wondered if I was a homosexual, interested in younger boys, which I wasn't at all. I was quite interested in girls. But I stayed on because it's continued to meet my needs, as I didn't get that met in sports.
And you remember looking at old issues of Boy's Life and finding advertisements in Boy's Life for guns.
Yes. Hunting was considered positively by the Boy Scouts. It was a talent. So the Boy Scouts were interested in various kinds of talents. And so shooting was one of many kinds of talents. Going camping was a talent, in a sense, which I greatly valued. And so from the standpoint of the boy's life, guns did not have necessarily a negative focus, that they tried to teach boys to use guns responsibly.
Well, ultimately, your book, of course, explores, among other things, the way in which gun violence in our country has emerged in some really terrible ways. You outline some of the most notable instances of, for instance, mass shootings and so on. And you chronicle some of the efforts to enact gun legislation, gun control legislation, regulation of guns. And of course, so many of those efforts have been largely unsuccessful. At the end of your book, you give some suggestions about what we might do in terms of trying to bring about effective change. And one of the things that you touch on, which is something you mentioned earlier in the book, is that part of our gun culture is the entertainment that we have that, in a sense, celebrates gun ownership. And you would like to see this, in a sense, changed.
I think we need a revolution in our gun entertainment. As I say, as a teenager, I went to the movies on Saturday afternoon and saw programs of gun violence, really. That gun violence was a way of hooking an audience. That it included drama, that one of the forms of gun violence was against Indians. That had become part of gun culture. So in the early 1800s, Americans were still in conflict with the Indians, trying to constrict their territories. The Indians, of course, resisted that. And so that conflict boiled over into actual wars at times between the Indians and the whites. And, of course, also guns were needed on plantations to be sure that the blacks, who outnumbered the whites on the plantation, did not revolt, because the whites were very concerned that the black slaves did not have guns. And even after emancipation, the whites still wanted to have a dominance over the blacks, who were free but nevertheless had to work on the white plantations. So there was a concern that blacks not get guns and that Indians not get guns. And it's only us white folks that had that right. And that right enabled us to engage in hunting as a sport, because it was no longer needed to put food on the table. But that tradition of hunting had been entertaining in itself. And so there were forces in society that continued to produce guns for hunting as a sport. But also these movies, and then the movie culture just simply transferred itself to television.
And it's interesting that your book actually talks about how, when we think about entertainment that involves guns, we can go a long way before the emergence of radio or television to find in some of the books and short stories that were written in early America that even then there is a fascination with guns. In our last closing minutes, though, a couple of minutes, what would you see as, for you, from your perspective, as hoping that we can begin to enact gun control measures? What do you see as the most effective path forward in terms of making that happen?
My suggestion is to walk away from the gun culture. I'm not interested in trying to eliminate the Second Amendment. That would be preposterous. You can't do it. But what you can do is walk away from the gun culture. And I think the entertainment industry should lead the way. It's not doing it, but it should. And the British actually have an interesting alternative. They have drama programs that talk about gun violence, but it's always, it happened yesterday. They do not show gun violence. What they show are efforts to solve mysteries about who done it. And so they have the drama of gun violence without the showing of gun violence. So that would be a version of what American entertainment might do. But really what I think would be much more positive is to show how people are able to figure out how to solve problems without violence.
Wouldn't that be a nice world if we lived in which violence wasn't the first option that so many people reach for? Well, your book really gives us a lot to think about, and I think you forcefully set forth your perspective on this issue, which of course continues to generate so much conversation and concern on both sides of the aisle. Your book again is titled Gun Crazy America, A History and Critique of Our Gun Culture. Is this a book that people can purchase, for instance, through Amazon?
Yes, it is.
All right. Again, the title, Gun Crazy America. And the author, Dr. Frank Edgerton, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Wisconsin, Parkside. Professor Edgerton, I was so glad that we could have this conversation today. And I'm also grateful to your good friend, Mary Beth Zilke, for helping to make this conversation possible and for delivering you safe and sound to the radio station studios for us to have this conversation today. Thank you so much and very best wishes to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, among other things, we're going to be previewing for you Racine's Starving Artist Fair, which is going to be occurring this Saturday, the 7th of August, on the beautiful grounds of the DeKoven Center. On Friday, you'll hear my conversation, newly recorded, with sports writer Jason Reed, the author of a really interesting and illuminating book called Rise of the Black Quarterback, What It Means for America. It's sort of shocking to think about, but not that long ago, it was all but unthinkable for large swaths of the American public for a black man to even consider trying to be the quarterback on a football team. And of course, now it is something that thankfully we think very little about, but it is a really interesting and checkered history. And he explores it in his really fascinating book, in which he also paints vivid portraits of a number of notable black quarterbacks who helped paved the way. And so he discusses such talented athletes as Warren Moon, Colin Kaepernick, and many, many others. That will be Friday on The Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning.